rescuers dug through rubble to find survivors of Morocco's recent deadly earthquake.
On Monday, search teams from Spain and Britain joined efforts to find survivors.
Plus, with tolling bells, personal tributes, and tears, Americans observe the 22nd anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil.
There is no graveyard. This is the final resting place. It's sacred, it's special, and it's important to be here and honor them.
And President Biden marked 9/11 with an event at an Alaska military base.
The Al-Qaeda threat from Afghanistan and Pakistan has reached a historic low.
Today is Tuesday, September 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Rescuers raced against time on Monday to find survivors in the rubble more than 48 hours after Morocco's deadliest earthquake in over six decades that killed nearly 2,500 people. Reuters' Edward Barron reports.
Rescuers have been racing to find those clinging to life in the rubble of Morocco's deadliest earthquake in more than six decades. The disaster's devastated villages in the High Atlas Mountains. Here in Amizmiz, more bodies were recovered late on Sunday night. On Monday, search teams from Spain and Britain joined efforts to find survivors. The 6.8 magnitude quake struck late on Friday, 45 miles southwest of Marrakesh. And with many homes built of mud bricks and timber or cement and breeze blocks, structures crumbled easily. Hamid Ben Henna described how his eight-year-old boy, Marouane, died in his home.
It all started between 11 and 11:30 p.m. We were having dinner. I asked my son to bring a knife from the kitchen to cut dessert. He didn't bring it because as soon as he left the kitchen, the earthquake struck. He ran here where you can see rubble. He was buried beneath 1.5 to 2 meters of rubble.
Marouane's mother spoke of her escape.
When we descended to the ground floor after the quake, the door was blocked by rocks, but we escaped through the neighbor's house. We found a woman and her son and a small girl stuck in rubble with only their heads appearing. We started dragging until my husband came and helped us save them.
Many survivors spent a third night outside, their homes destroyed or rendered unsafe by Morocco's most powerful quake since at least 1900. Survivors struggling to find shelter and supplies have voiced criticism of what they've described as an initially slow government response. Morocco has deployed the army as part of its response. It said it's reinforcing search and rescue teams, providing drinking water and distributing food, tents and blankets. King Mohammed VI thanks Spain, Qatar, the UK and United Arab Emirates for sending aid, state TV reported on Sunday, adding that Morocco had assessed aid needs and considered the importance of coordinating relief efforts before accepting their help.
That was Reuters reporter Edwin Barron. Americans across the country on Monday observed the 9/11 anniversary with events spanning from moments of silence at the World Trade Center, the site of one of the 2001 attacks, to gatherings in small towns. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
A bell tolls at ground zero during the reading of the almost 3,000 names of those killed on 9/11. Gabrielle Gabrielli, who lost her uncle, Richard Gabrielle, says 22 years later, it's still heartbreaking.
There is no graveyard. This is the final resting place. It's sacred, it's special, and it's important to be here and honor them.
Edward Edelman, who lost his brother-in-law, Daniel McKinley, says you find a way to go forward, but 9/11 is always there.
For those of us who lost people on that day, that day is still happening.
Commemorations stretch from this site at New York's World Trade Center to the Pentagon in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, all the way to a military base in Alaska, where President Biden is taking part in a ceremony. Julie Walker, New York.
9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden was said to have maintained a base of operations and military training facilities in the mountains of Afghanistan. Shortly after bin Laden accepted responsibility for al-Qaeda's deadly attack on the U.S., then-President George W. Bush expressed America's desire to get him, dead or alive. This prompted the president to issue demands to the Taliban, who were ruling Afghanistan at the time, that included turning over bin Laden and other terrorist leaders to the U.S. In an October 2001 televised address, Bush announced that American forces were invading Afghanistan in what he termed carefully targeted actions designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens, unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
In a recent report, the UN said al-Qaeda has established itself back in Afghanistan and is again recruiting new members, 22 years after the 9/11 attacks. VOA Afghan Services' Shaista Sadat Lami spoke with Bruce Hoffman, a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations, about the return of the Taliban into power in Afghanistan. She asked Hoffman, what does the return of the Taliban mean for counterterrorism?
The return of the Taliban is nothing short of disastrous. Not only is this totalitarian, authoritarian, discriminatory in religious terms, homophobic, misogynist group now in power, but it has served, their reconquest of Afghanistan has served as a clarion call or as an example to terrorists all over the world, including al-Qaeda, including terrorists that have nothing to do with the Taliban, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in the Gaza Strip, even the Proud Boys in the United States, have all cited the Taliban's victory 2 years ago as proof positive that if you are persistent enough, if you refuse to give up, if you're patient, your efforts will eventually be rewarded.
That was Bruce Hoffman from the Council on Foreign Relations speaking with Shaista Sadat Lami of VOA's Afghan Service. We're following these and other stories from around the world. Chile on Monday marked 50 years since a violent coup by Augusto Pinochet against socialist President Salvador Allende ushered in two decades of military rule that saw thousands killed and ceded the country's market-led economic model. Thousands of Israeli anti-government protesters rallied at the Supreme Court on Monday, the eve of a historic hearing on a bid by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition to curb the court's powers. And the head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog said on Monday that he was concerned the international community was losing interest in holding Iran to account over its advancing nuclear program. This is VOA News. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's trip to Russia and meeting with President Vladimir Putin will be a full-scale visit. For more about the complex relationship between North Korea, formerly known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, and Russia, VOA Steve Miller spoke with Alexis Dudden, professor of history, specializing in modern Japan and Korea and international history at the University of Connecticut.
What do you see as putting this in context, what's in it for Kim Jong-un to go to this Eastern Economic Conference in Russia?
That's an excellent question. And there's a really interesting parallel with meeting with Donald Trump in Singapore and Hanoi. Kim Jong-un has already met with Vladimir Putin, and this just further legitimates his rule. And so for him, this is, it's his first trip post-COVID outside the country. And it shows that he is a player on the international stage, which for an entirely closed country, for all intents and purposes, as North Korea is for most North Koreans, when this photo op plays out in the domestic press in North Korea, he's a global leader.
You know, speaking about that, the global leader, and in meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, we've just had the Foundation Day festivities in North Korea. You know, Kim Jong-un released pictures of that, what he was calling the new nuclear submarine. It's widely also suspected that perhaps this meeting between Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin will be about some kind of arms deal in which Russia would purchase weapons from North Korea. And going back, right, 1950, it was Russia and to some extent China who are supplying weapons to North Korea with their war against the South. Historically, what do you see as the significance of that kind of interaction?
What Kim is doing is showing he can act independently. What Putin is showing is they can act independently despite the war criminal warrant out on Putin. He can go to Vladivostok to the very, I have stood in that same venue giving a lecture totally publicly. It's not, you know, that was invited. That was years ago, but it's a venue in which international forum take place. And so Kim and Putin will have a photo op to show that there is what used to be called the non-aligned movement, but that they are able to interact without the interference of the United States telling them what to do. Now, obviously, that's constrained, but he'll get there. And Putin and he will show that there is an alternative to the Washington dialogue, and it threatens Washington's view of how to organize our allies in the war that Putin began. And so for both Putin and Kim, this is a way to demonstrate that they are still in power. Noticeably absent, of course, is China.
So given that China is not there, the other, you know, major player in the region that is a close ally of North Korea, what are you looking at in terms of possible outcomes or as a possible direction of where things may go next once this conference concludes?
Well, I think it will be interesting to parse what is traded for traded. You know, what North Korea wants from Russia is the technology to use the weapons it's developing. And that's what they have received from Russia over the past, I don't know, even 20 years that a lot of people in Washington missed, you know, to achieve the arc on their weapons, to achieve the Mach speed that North Korea has achieved, came from Russian scientists employed in Pyongyang. So whatever technology is transferred, that's what Pyongyang wants primarily. Secondarily, maybe it will receive food imports. And that, to me personally, is something we all should pay attention to, because nobody's paying attention to the North Korean people in the middle of all of this, because we keep hearing reports of a renewed food crisis. You know, but we're not talking about that. We're only talking about missiles. And so let's measure what technology is transferred and how much food is transferred from Russia, especially when there's this enormous discussion about grain exports from Ukraine to the rest of the world. Is Russia going to transfer food to North Korea? What Russia wants clearly is whatever weapons, whatever it can get from North Korea. I think also important to remember is, will North Korean soldiers be committed? Because, you know, you mentioned about the Korean War. Russia, yes, the Soviet Union, excuse me, was technically, you know, of course, on North Korea's side. They didn't really show up compared to the Chinese. And so Chinese soldiers are the ones that preserved what we now call North Korea. And if North Korean soldiers are committed to the battle that is ongoing in Ukraine, that's also a different ballgame for the Washington alliance to consider.
Alexis Dudden is a professor of history at the University of Connecticut. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Steve.
A series of coups in Western Africa is putting the unity and capability of the regional bloc, ECOWAS, to the test as it seeks to restore civilian rule in countries such as Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Niger. Experts warn the ability of ECOWAS to address security challenges is jeopardized by the rise of new military leaders. Mohamed Youssef reports.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is grappling with how to deal with the military junta in Niger, which has been in power now for over a month. On July 26th, soldiers placed President Mohamed Bazoum under house arrest, accusing his administration of mismanaging the country's resources and allowing security situation to deteriorate. In response, ECOWAS imposed trade sanctions on Niger and even threatened military intervention. But the ongoing political and security crisis in Niger, Burkina Faso, Guinea and Mali are proving to be challenging for the other 11 ECOWAS member countries. Paul Melly, a consulting fellow of the Africa Programme at Chatham House, says the coup leaders are not adhering to the established rules and engagement of the regional bloc.
A series of coups, if you like, is a really serious blow to what had been ECOWAS's greatest strength. And the fact that the military putschist regimes are defying the long-established ECOWAS tradition of collaboration in setting governance rules and in managing crises is a real threat, a real challenge to the region's unity.
In 2017, ECOWAS garnered praise for its collective military action against Gambian President Yahya Jammeh, forcing him to step down after he lost an election to the current President Adama Barrow. Francis Mangeni, a regional integration expert, notes that the current situation is quite different, with some coups enjoying apparent support from the people.
Now we're having situations where it's not that clear, where you have the people themselves apparently supporting the coups. So this introduces a certain element, you know, of complexity. So in other words, the legitimacy of the constitutionally elected government seems to be in question. And this is an interesting thing really to say, because if they are constitutional, they are supposed to be legitimate. But apparently the people don't think so.
African Union leaders have been slow to condemn heads of state who change constitutions to extend their terms and alter age limits to remain in power. According to the experts, the rise of military takeovers in Africa is due to leaders overstaying power, electoral malpractices, and elected leaders' failure to work for the betterment of their citizens. The African Union has already suspended six countries where military forces seize power from civilians, including the four ECOWAS countries, Gabon and Sudan. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
As Russia closes in on the city of Kupiansk in the north end of Ukraine's war zone and retreats from towns in the south, city workers man their posts at a firehouse and post office near the front lines, but all hope to find safety away from the war. Some residents featured in this story have requested that their last names be withheld for safety reasons. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
On the ground floor of this firehouse, there is cause for celebration. The war isn't over, but it is moving away slowly, as Ukraine fights bitterly for every meter in this counteroffensive. There are only 6 to 7 bombings a day here in Velika Novosilka, former firefighters say, making the Ukrainian town safe enough for residents to envision a future.
It's much quieter now, much quieter and more peaceful. They're still shelling, but I'm telling you, it's much calmer now. People are going out more, to the grocery. It has become safer.
But about 6 hours' drive away, in the city of Kupiansk, on the other end of Ukraine's war zone, the battle is getting closer. At this post office, residents mail out their valuables as they prepare to evacuate.
No, Maybe the city will be bombed and nothing will be left. I'm going to leave as well. I'm sending the most necessary things.
About a year ago, Ukraine recaptured Kupiansk after more than 6 months of Russian occupation. Russia appears to again have the city in its sights, and residents fear a full-on assault could be coming soon. In the meantime, postal workers deliver pensions issued for months in advance as the Ukrainian government anticipates being cut off from the city. And many families who remained through the last Russian occupation are now leaving. Postal workers say when their office closes, they will also flee.
We will stay and work while this post office is open.
And in Velika Novosilka, near the counteroffensive, despite the war moving away, locals are not coming back. Homes are destroyed, and many who braved the last battles remain buried in their gardens. But in the firehouse, the few remaining residents show off treasures they saved from the war and talk about building a museum one day when the war is over. A little less bombing gives them hope the town will come back, they say, and perhaps a reason to dance. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Velika Novosilka and Kupiansk, Ukraine.
And finally, the Speleological Federation of Turkey said rescuers pulled an American researcher out of a Turkish cave early Tuesday, more than a week after he became seriously ill 1,000 meters below its entrance. Teams from across Europe had rushed to Morka Cave in southern Turkey's Taurus Mountains to aid Mark Dickey, a 40-year-old experienced caver. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When it comes to the effects of climate change, of the 20 most impacted countries in the world, 17 are in Africa, said United States Special Envoy for Climate John Kerry. Speaking at the Africa Climate Summit 2023 in Nairobi, Kenya, he said that this problem that we are facing is human-made. It is about pollution. Indeed, Africa is on the forefront of the climate crisis, one that is generated by the unabated burning of fossil fuel. 20 countries produced 80% of all the emissions, said Mr. Kerry. It is critical for all of those 20 countries to immediately take steps to get on the path to the Paris Agreement.
If justice is to mean anything, it certainly has to mean that if there's going to be a transition, everybody has to be able to share in the benefits of that transition. And right now, it is clear that you can't talk about a just transition, about a just transition, when some people, there's no transition at all. Or when some people, there is acute, unfair debt that swallows and drowns the choices that those countries have to make.
Adaptation is key to survival. Every 18 days, we have a $1 billion climate event somewhere on this planet, so adaptation is critical, said John Kerry.
President Biden has now launched a program called PREPARE, the President's Emergency Program for Adaptation. And he has committed that we are going to help at least a half a billion people in developing countries, especially in Africa, to be able to adapt to the worst impacts of this crisis.
Mr. Kerry announced that the United States will provide an additional $20 million to the African Adaptation Initiative for the Food Security Accelerator, which will invest in agricultural businesses. Another $10 million will go to the Climate Resilient Adaptation, Finance, and Technology Transfer Facility for scaling technologies to advance adaptation, such as cold chain food storage.
We've learned that adaptation saves lives, creates jobs, and obviously, it's just plain old common sense. Roads and bridges that are built today can only spur growth and curb poverty if they're still standing tomorrow.
Africa suffers to a great degree the worst impacts of the climate crisis, said Special Envoy Kerry. It is essential that every country step up to help other nations, and particularly Africa at this point, in order to be able to adapt to the climate impacts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.